Picture the most famous Jewish meal in all of human history. You are probably imagining a group of men sitting solemnly at a standard wooden table.
Right, that is the classic Renaissance painting image we all have in our heads.
But the historical reality, they were actually eating that meal using strict formal Greek etiquette.
Which is pretty mind-blowing when you really think about it.
It really is. Or consider ancient tax collection, which, when you peel back all the historical layers, functioned almost exactly like a state-sponsored multi-level marketing scheme.
Oh, absolutely. A complete pyramid scheme.
And then there is the highly revered ancient philosopher who point-blank refused to eat bacon. But not for any deep spiritual reason. He claimed it was simply too delicious.
Yeah, when you actually look at the archaeological dirt and, you know, the surviving papyri, the reality of how these ancient people lived totally shatters the neat, sterilized versions of history we are usually taught.
So true. Today we are bringing you along on a deep dive into Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino's incredibly revealing lecture, Judaism Before Jesus.
It is a fascinating piece of research.
Our mission for you today is to explore what really happens when a massive dominant global culture, in this case the ancient Greeks, crashes headfirst into a fiercely independent, tradition-bound local culture like ancient Judea. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
Because we are not just talking about armies conquering land. We are talking about the collision of everyday life, money, fashion, and family.
To really understand the mechanics of this collision, you have to rewind to the death of Alexander the Great.
Right, so we are in the late 4th century BC.
Exactly. Alexander had basically swallowed up the known world, but upon his death, his massive empire immediately fractured. It didn't stay whole.
It just fell apart.
Pretty much. His generals, who are known as the Diadochi, ruthlessly carved up the territory among themselves. And Judea, this tiny, deeply traditional strip of land, well, it found itself caught directly in the crossfire of the resulting superpowers.
So it basically becomes a buffer state, like an imperial tug of war.
Precisely. After the dust of Alexander's empire settled, two main powers emerged fighting over the region. You had the Ptolemies, who controlled Egypt and Palestine to the south, and the Seleucids, who controlled Syria and Mesopotamia to the north. Initially, the Jews in Judea ended up under the control of the Ptolemies.
How did the Ptolemies operate? Because, I mean, you always assume an invading empire immediately forces everyone to speak their language and worship their gods.
You would think so, but the Ptolemies actually took a surprisingly hands-off approach to the culture and religion of the people they conquered.
Really? They just didn't care.
They really didn't. They harbored a deep aristocratic disdain for the locals. They preferred to just stay in their wealthy Hellenistic bubbles, which actually worked out in Judea's favor.
Huh.
The Ptolemaic administration essentially communicated, keep your religion, keep your Sabbath, keep your kosher dietary laws. We have zero interest in your culture. Just pay your taxes.
So it's just pure economic extraction.
Oh, it was extraction on a devastating scale. The Ptolemies instituted a system of revenue collection known as tax farming, which was, well, it was structurally designed to encourage corruption.
Right.
They didn't use salaried government officials. Instead, they auctioned off the right to collect taxes to the highest bidder.
This is the part of the research that totally blew my mind. I need to make sure I'm understanding the mechanism here because it sounds like a horrific corporate pyramid scheme.
It basically was.
The empire isn't just saying, give us 10%.
Yeah.
They are legally incentivizing every single middle manager to embezzle from the people below them.
Yes. Let's trace the money to see how ruthless it actually was. The Ptolemaic crown would demand that a specific regional magistrate produce, let's say, 500 talents of gold for the fiscal year.
Okay, 500 talents. Got it.
That magistrate then goes to the district overseer beneath him and claims the empire requires 600 talents of gold.
Right.
And when that overseer manages to squeeze 600 talents out of the district, the magistrate sends 500 up the chain to the king and legally pockets the 100 talent surplus for himself.
And it just cascades downward from there?
It cascades all the way to the very bottom. That district overseer turns around to his local village underlings and inflates the quota again.
Of course.
Telling each of them they're responsible for raising 150 talents. By the time this quota reaches the actual local tax collectors knocking on doors, they are absolutely shaking down the peasant farmers.
Just taking whatever they can.
Exactly. Seizing grain, threatening violence to get as much as they physically can just to ensure they get their cut before passing the rest up the pyramid.
It fundamentally incentivizes terrorizing the lower class.
Yeah.
And the only reason we know the gritty day-to-day details of this financial nightmare is because of a totally accidental discovery, right?
It's Zenon papyri. Yeah, this is a great story. In 1914, two Egyptian men were out in the dirt, literally digging for fertilizer.
Fertilizer. You can't make this up.
You really can't. And they stumbled upon a massive cache of about 1,800 ancient documents. These turned out to be the personal and financial papers of a Ptolemaic treasury officer named Zenon from around the 3rd century BC.
Wow.
The documents themselves are mostly dry financial records, you know, grain prices, receipts, slave sales, but they provide a microscopic look into the brutal economic reality the people of Palestine were living under.
But then the geopolitical winds shift and the management changes.
They do. Around 204 BC, after a series of brutal conflicts called the Syrian Wars, the Seleucid Empire, led by Antiochus III, finally seizes control of Judea from the Ptolemies.
And they had a totally different vibe.
Completely different ruling philosophy. They were not hands-off. They were deeply paternalistic.
Okay.
They viewed Greek culture Hellenism as the absolute pinnacle of human achievement. And they actively wanted to bless their Eastern subjects by civilizing them.
I always assumed cultural assimilation in the ancient world was driven by, like, philosophy or forced conversion at sword point. But the sources show the Seleucids used a much more effective weapon. Tax loopholes.
Economics always drives cultural shifts. The Seleucids offered massive financial incentives to any city that officially reorganized itself into a Greek-style polis.
Wait, I need to stop you there. Adopting Greek culture wasn't some deep spiritual awakening for the people of Judea. It was literally the ancient equivalent of a modern corporation changing its logo to get a tax loophole.
That is the underlying reality of the Hellenistic period. The rise of what historians call the Hellenizing party in Jerusalem wasn't driven by a sudden profound appreciation for Aristotelian logic.
Right.
Or a sudden belief in the Greek pantheon. It was driven by elite greed.
Just following the money.
Exactly. If the aristocratic leaders of Jerusalem successfully petitioned the Seleucid king to recognize them as a polis, they received significant tax breaks. Furthermore, they gained access to royal funding to build lucrative public works like gymnasia.
And a gymnasium back then wasn't just a place to lift weights, right? It was the absolute epicenter of Greek educational and social life.
It was everything. It was where the youth were trained in Greek rhetoric, athletics, and politics. Getting funding for a gymnasium and a theater meant you were now plugged into the global economic network of the empire.
But this must have created an unimaginable class divide. I mean, if you were a wealthy merchant dealing with government contracts, you have to play the Greek game.
You have no choice.
You have to speak Greek, because that's the lingua franca. You adopt a Greek public name for your business dealings while quietly keeping your Hebrew name at home. It's like having a corporate alter ego.
It really is. And meanwhile, the lower class Jews, the farmers and laborers who are still fiercely maintaining their native culture and speaking Aramaic, they are watching this happen.
Just rolling their eyes, probably.
Oh, absolutely. They are watching their wealthy neighbors prancing around the city in Greek clothing, fumbling through Greek grammar and aggressively trying to assimilate.
It must have looked ridiculous.
The lower classes viewed these elites as a bunch of buffoonish wannabes who were selling out their heritage for a tax break. What's fascinating here is that because the motivation for this shift was so heavily tied to financial and political gain, the cultural changes we actually see in the archaeological record from this era are almost entirely superficial.
Yeah, when you look at what actually changed, it was just window dressing. It was the cosmetics of daily life,
yeah,
starting with urban planning.
Right. For centuries throughout the Old Testament period, the functional center of any Israelite city was the city gate.
Which is where all the action happened.
Exactly. That is where the elders gathered, where legal judgments were handed down, and where major business transactions occurred. But under Greek influence, the entire focal point of public life shifted inward to the Greek-style city square, the Agora.
You also see theaters popping up everywhere,
right,
which conservative Jews deeply distrusted.
Oh, they hated them.
There's that hilarious story in the Talmud about a prominent rabbi who vehemently opposed the construction of a local theater. A Hellenistic king practically drags this rabbi to a performance to prove it's harmless.
Right. I love this story.
And afterward, the rabbi reluctantly admits, okay, I guess the performance didn't actually violate any specific laws of our fathers.
He was so disappointed he couldn't condemn it.
Exactly.
But the visual landscape transformed everywhere. Buildings in Judea suddenly featured ornate Greek Corinthian capitals on their columns. And the shift in personal fashion was incredibly stark.
The visual evidence for this is really striking. If you look at ancient Assyrian reliefs depicting Israelites from earlier centuries, they are always wearing these heavy, long, multi-layered robes.
Very traditional ancient Near Eastern garb.
Right. But the Greeks favored much shorter tunics that pinned at the shoulders, leaving the legs bare.
And the ultimate proof that the Jewish populace adopted this Greek fashion comes from a Roman coin minted much later in 70 AD by the Emperor Vespasian.
Ah, the Judaea Capta coin.
Yes, it was issued to celebrate Rome's destruction of Jerusalem. The coin depicts a captured, subjugated Jewish man, and on that Roman propaganda, the Jewish captive is explicitly depicted with bare legs, wearing the shorter Hellenistic style robe.
Wow.
The assimilation reached the absolute highest levels of power, too. King Herod the Great, ruling decades later, completely abandoned the traditional conical crown worn by ancient kings and chose to wear a Greek laurel wreath.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because the cosmetic changes didn't just stop at clothes and buildings. They permeated into the most intimate spaces of domestic life, like the dining room.
Oh, the physical posture of dining underwent a massive revolution.
Traditionally, ancient Israelites sat cross-legged on the floor or on simple mats to eat their meals. But the Greeks, they reclined on padded couches or benches, leaning on their left elbows while servants brought them food.
This reclining posture started as an elite Greek practice, but eventually trickled down to become the absolute standard for any formal meal or banquet in the region.
Which means, and this completely reframed my mental image of biblical history, if the Greeks reclined on benches to eat, and the New Testament explicitly describes Jesus and his disciples reclining at the table during the Last Supper,
Yes.
then the most famous iconic Jewish meal in all of history was actually eaten using standard Greek etiquette.
It really was. The cultural osmosis was so pervasive that reclining wasn't even viewed as a foreign practice by that point. It was just how a proper meal was conducted.
Okay, so changing your clothes or putting a Corinthian column on your house or buying a new dining room couch, that's all surface level. That's easy to adopt without changing who you are.
Sure.
But what happens when these Hellenistic ideals collide with the actual core of Judean life? What happens to the family structure? Because that is where the tension becomes impossible to ignore.
This is where we uncover the much darker side of this cultural exchange. The Greeks and the Jews held fundamentally opposing worldviews regarding the family unit.
Very opposing.
The Greeks intentionally kept their families very, very small. They often resorted to the tragic practice of infanticide, particularly for female infants.
The sources explain the geography behind this, right?
Yeah.
The soil in mainland Greece was incredibly poor and rocky.
Terrible for agriculture.
So they lived with a constant underlying societal fear of starvation and overpopulation. So, culturally, having too many children wasn't seen as a joy. It was viewed as a literal mathematical threat to the community's survival.
Contrast that with Jewish culture, which developed in the more agriculturally forgiving Fertile Crescent. Their theology explicitly viewed large families as a divine blessing.
Be fruitful and multiply.
Exactly. The sheer size of Jewish families baffled and deeply annoyed Greek and Roman observers. However, as Greek influence seeped into Judea, it began to severely degrade the social status of women.
The downgrade is undeniable. If you look at the Old Testament, like the famous Proverbs 31 passage, you see a woman of significant economic agency.
She is a powerhouse in that text.
She really is. She is independently evaluating real estate, buying fields, negotiating contracts, and running a complex household manufacturing business.
By contrast, Hellenistic culture suffered from endemic misogyny. In the Greek legal framework, women were essentially viewed as perpetual minors. They were generally prohibited from entering into financial contracts or legal agreements without the explicit approval of a male guardian, usually a husband or father. We see the devastation of this clash most vividly in how marriage customs changed.
I really struggle to wrap my head around this shift. So the traditional Jewish custom was the bride price, where a prospective husband paid the bride's family. But the Greeks used a dowry system, and the Jewish elites actually adopted the Greek way.
They did, and the economic implications were massive. Under the traditional bride price system, a man paying to marry a woman like King David, paying a bride price for Saul's daughter, functioned as a social declaration of her inherent value.
Right.
It also served as an economic safety net for her family. The Greek dowry system operated on the exact opposite premise.
Because they view daughters differently.
Completely. Because Greek culture viewed daughters as financial liabilities, A father was culturally obligated to pay a prospective husband a large sum of money or property just to take his daughter off his hands.
Wait, why on earth would the Jewish lower classes ever agree to a system that treated their daughters like liabilities you had to pay someone to take? That is a massive downgrade.
Well, the lower classes didn't want to. It ruined them economically, but the Hellenized Jewish elites forced the shift.
How so?
If a wealthy Jewish merchant wanted to secure a political alliance by marrying his daughter to a Greek official or a Hellenized aristocratic family, he couldn't ask for a bride price. He would be laughed out of the room.
Oh, I see.
He had to provide a massive dowry to prove his wealth and conform to international standards. As the elites normalized the dowry, it trickled down, forcing poorer families into crippling debt just to marry off their daughters.
It completely destabilizes the family economy. And the sources also point to a wild proliferation of divorce during this period, right?
Yes. The concept of marriage shifted from a sacred covenant to a manageable civic contract. We have a remarkable cache of documents known as the Babatha Archives, dating from around 130 AD.
Who was Balatha?
Babatha was a wealthy, propertied Jewish woman living near the Dead Sea. Her surviving legal documents reveal she was divorced multiple times, and the paperwork suggests she actively initiated some of those proceedings herself.
Which is totally new.
Right. In strictly traditional Jewish law, only the husband held the power to initiate a divorce. Under the Hellenistic legal framework, divorce became a normalized contractual expectation that could be leveraged by whoever held the wealth.
Were there any aspects of the Greek family structure that positively influenced Judea? I mean, was it all bad?
Actually, the one significant positive change was the Greek insistence on strict legal monogamy.
Okay.
While wealthy Greeks certainly kept mistresses, a man could only have one official legal wife. Traditional Jewish law, as later codified in the Talmud, technically permitted a man to have up to three wives, even though polygamy was relatively rare for everyday people.
Right, mostly just for kings or the super wealthy.
Exactly. But the overwhelming cultural weight of Greek monogamy eventually helped phase the practice of polygamy entirely out of mainstream Jewish culture.
Okay, so they changed their clothes, their economy, and the legal contracts governing their marriages. But what about the deeply held religious beliefs? Did the Jewish people actually adopt the Greek mind?
To answer that, you have to look at a map. Geography dictated the depth of assimilation. There was a profound psychological difference between the Jews living in Judea and the diaspora Jews.
The ones who had spread out across the empire.
Right, those living in major Hellenistic hubs like Alexandria and Egypt.
That makes perfect sense. If you are living in Judea, your physical landscape is your identity. You could walk outside, point to a specific valley, and say, that is where David fought Goliath.
Yes,
You
exactly.
have the physical temple in Jerusalem. Your geography anchors your faith.
But if you are a diaspora Jew living in Alexandria, you are entirely detached from those physical anchors. You are swimming in a dominant, cosmopolitan, pagan culture that rewards assimilation. Consequently, the diaspora Jews Hellenized far more deeply on a philosophical level.
The ultimate example of this is Philo of Alexandria.
Oh, Philo is fascinating.
He was a brilliant, highly Hellenized Jewish philosopher who dedicated his life to proving that the Hebrew Bible and the philosophy of Plato were essentially teaching the exact same truths.
Philo was as deeply immersed in Greek intellectualism as a Jewish thinker could possibly be, yet there was a line he would not cross. He stubbornly refused to eat pork, adhering to Jewish dietary laws.
And his justification for refusing pork is absolutely hilarious.
It really is.
He didn't just lean on his faith and say God forbids it. He was too much of a Greek philosopher for that. Instead, he claimed that he had heard from others that pork was the most delectable of all meats.
Right.
Therefore, consuming it wouldn't just be unkosher. It would be an unacceptable philosophical overindulgence.
It's a brilliant philosophical loophole. I'm not eating it because of primitive superstition. I am abstaining because I am practicing stoic self-control.
So clever.
It demonstrates that even for the most culturally blended minds, a core Jewish identity remained, and back in the homeland of Judea, the locals largely ignored Greek philosophy altogether.
The sources highlight this perfectly. The Mishnah, a foundational text of Jewish oral tradition, actually mentions the Greek poet Homer.
It does.
But the context of the mention makes it painfully obvious that the Judean rabbis had absolutely no earthly idea what was actually written in the Iliad or the Odyssey.
Which is a staggering realization. Every single educated Greek boy grew up memorizing Homer. It was the bedrock of their entire civilization.
Right.
The fact that the most educated scholars in Judea didn't even know his basic storylines proves that Hellenization in the homeland was incredibly shallow. The first century Jewish historian Josephus even noted that learning to speak multiple languages beautifully was considered the lowly skill of a slave.
Really, a slave skill.
Because any common servant could be taught to do it. For the Judean Jews, mastering their own ancient Jewish law was the singular mark of intellectual prestige.
But there's one massive, glaring exception where the Jews did completely buy in to Greek thinking. And I need you to explain this to me because I am completely lost on the logic here. They adopted astrology.
They did. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the mechanism of how they justified this makes perfect sense.
Okay, because historically, the Hebrew Bible relentlessly mocked Babylonian astrology.
Drew really mocked it.
The Babylonians looked at the planets and stars, believed they were literal conscious gods, and worshipped them to decipher omens. The biblical prophets vehemently rejected this, stating the stars were just unthinking lights in the sky created by a single god.
Right, so astrology is pure, unadulterated idolatry.
Exactly. But then the Greeks come along, and they manage to repackage Babylonian astrology as science.
By utilizing the physics of Aristotle, Greek astronomers hypothesized a geocentric universe where the Earth was stationary in the center. They believed the planets and stars were embedded in massive, invisible physical spheres made of a crystalline substance.
Okay, I'm with you so far.
As these giant spheres rotated around the Earth at different speeds, the Greeks argued that they physically rubbed and ground against one another.
Wait, really? So the Greeks believed that giant invisible spheres grinding together in space generated physical friction.
Yes.
And that this cosmic friction generated heat and energy that physically altered the environment and events down on Earth.
Exactly. They removed the conscious gods from the equation and replaced them with mechanical physics. The planets weren't making decisions. They were just giant gears in a cosmic machine generating friction.
And because the Greeks framed it as mechanical friction, the Jews finally said, oh, well, if it's just physics and friction, it's not idolatry, we can participate.
It's amazing, isn't it? It allowed them to embrace the practice without violating their strict monotheism. The archaeological evidence for this compromise is stunning. We have actual astrological horoscopes preserved among the Dead Sea Scrolls.
No way.
Oh, yeah. They weren't using them to predict the future like pagans did. They were using them to determine a person's physical and spiritual character traits based on the scientific alignment of the stars at their birth.
And it goes way beyond scrolls. There is a 5th century AD synagogue floor discovered in Palestine that features a massive, beautifully preserved mosaic of the full Greek zodiac.
It's a gorgeous mosaic.
They have the fish of Pisces, the lion of Leo, the twins of Gemini right there on the floor of a Jewish house of worship, which is insane considering just a few centuries earlier, Judeans were staging riots in the streets of Jerusalem over the mere presence of Roman animal imagery on public buildings.
It perfectly illustrates the subtle power of a dominant culture. You don't always have to conquer a people with swords to change their behavior. Sometimes you just have to rebrand your ideas in a language they can legally accept.
So what does this all mean? Let's bring everything we've uncovered today together. We've looked at this massive, centuries-long collision between the global Greek Empire and local Judea.
It's a huge cultural clash.
And we've seen how the Jewish people adopted the vast majority of the window dressing. They adopted the city squares, the shorter tunics, the business language, the dowry economics, the dining couches, and even the science of friction-based astrology.
All the external stuff.
But beneath all those heavy cosmetics, the Jewish soul, particularly in the homeland, remained stubbornly intact. They kept their ancient stories. They kept their core laws.
The artifacts changed, but the internal compass did not. And there is a profound, highly relevant lesson in that for anyone paying attention today.
Because if you are listening to this right now, you are living in an era of intense, inescapable globalization. We are all constantly pressured to adopt the culture of whatever tech platform, social algorithm, or massive corporate structure happens to be ruling the digital empire of our lives at this exact moment.
It's the exact same dynamic.
It really is. But this deep dive into history proves that you can put on the uniform of the dominant culture. You can learn the corporate jargon. You can use the trendy apps. You can participate in the global economy without actually surrendering your core identity or what you fundamentally value.
It is entirely possible to navigate the empire without becoming the empire. And that raises a fascinating thought experiment to leave you with.
Oh, I like thought experiments. Let's hear it.
Throughout our discussion today, we noted how future historians and scholars looked at the archaeological record. They dug up the Greek-style Corinthian columns. They read the Greek names on Jewish gravestones. They saw the zodiac mosaics.
Right.
And many initially assumed that the Jews had entirely lost their religion and surrendered their souls to the Greeks. The scholars looked at the mass-produced artifacts and completely misread the true hearts of the people who owned them.
Because just because a stonecutter learned to carve in Greek to get a tax break didn't mean his family stopped being Jewish when they went home for dinner.
Exactly. Which forces you to wonder, 1,000 years from now, when future archaeologists are digging through the ruins of our homes and they carefully catalog all the mass-produced, globalized objects we bought, and they analyze the dominant technology we use just to survive in our modern empire,
yeah,
what completely wrong assumptions are they going to make about what we actually believed in our hearts?